Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. For the past 16 years, the San Francisco International Ocean Film Festival has celebrated the beauty of the oceans and has worked to raise awareness about the fragile state of our marine ecosystems, coastal cultures, and the impact of climate change on marine life. One of the films screened in this year's festival takes us on a journey through the amazing world of endangered beluga whales. The documentary Call of the Baby Beluga begins with the story of a baby beluga that washes up on a gravel beach along the St. Lawrence River in Canada. The scientific team takes the unusual step of trying to save her by hoping that a wild female will adopt her. But the film is not just the story about this particular calf. It's the larger history of this complex mammal and the scientists who have worked for decades to save them. According to the film, few other wild animals are as closely connected to human beings as belugas from the St. Lawrence River. For centuries, humans have killed them, captured them, poisoned them, studied them, and loved them. It is a beautiful film, and it will be screening on Saturday, March 9th, and you can find more information about this particular film and the entire festival, which kicks off this Thursday at yourcallradio.org. And for those of you that live outside of the area, we will also ask our guest today how you can see the films in your area. Today, we are joined by Anna Blanco, Executive Director of the International Ocean Film Festival. Hi, Anna. Welcome back to the show, and congratulations on another great festival.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Suzanne Chisholm, an award-winning British Columbia-based documentary filmmaker and producer and co-director of Call of the Baby Beluga. Suzanne has also produced and co-directed Saving Luna and the Whale. She's produced and filmed more than 24 pieces for National Geographic Channel's Today Show. Hi, Suzanne. Thank you so much for joining us, and what a beautiful film. Suzanne, do we have you?
Yes, hello.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us today.
Thank you so much. We're also joined by Michael Parfit, an award-winning writer and filmmaker and co-director, writer and editor and director of photography for Call of the Baby Beluga. Hi, Michael. Thank you for joining us. And congratulations on the film. The footage is just so beautiful.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Well, Anna, I want to start off with you. This is one of my favorite film festivals. You bring in such amazing films. And I'm just wondering how things have really changed over the years now that the oceans are getting so much more media attention than ever. In fact, I just searched for the word oceans and came up with so many articles. I just want to read a couple headlines. Science News: oceans are warming due to climate change, yield fewer fish. The world's oceans are a gift to nature that we all have a duty to preserve. Climate change is killing the reefs. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Plastic pollution is now getting attention, and you brought films about plastic pollution a couple of years ago before it was getting mainstream attention. So what has really changed at the festival along with all of the new research that's now coming out?
Well, that's a really good question, Rose. I think what we're seeing more than anything now is we're seeing films coming from more countries. So I think this year we had a record submission of films from over 35 countries, and smaller countries are using film as a way to tell stories about the ocean. We're also seeing younger filmmakers submitting films, which is exciting because it's the next generation of our ocean leaders who are concerned and are raising awareness more than anybody at this point. We're also seeing better quality films. So the technology has gotten so much better, and so it enables people all over the world to actually make a film, whether it's 30 seconds or a full-length feature documentary. So with the amount of conversation that's happening about the ocean and climate change, we're seeing better films, we're seeing more films from more countries, and we're also seeing more subject matter. I think there's a tremendous increase in people realizing the value that film can have and the impact that it can have in terms of being able to tell a story that needs to be told.
And I won't ask you to mention favorites, but what is the process like in choosing these films, given that there are more of them and the quality has improved so much?
You know, I'm so fortunate. I have a team of about 10 volunteers that watch the films starting in July when we open up our call for submissions. And we all try to watch all of them. And we have very lively discussions about the subject matter, the content, the quality of the film, et cetera. And what it boils down to is, are there issues that need to be in the forefront? Are there issues that need to be put on the big screen? Is there some story that we have yet to tell? Is there a story that's an uplifting adventure story on the high seas that you would never be able to imagine could take place, but yet it did? So a lot of it is simply, what have we shown? What needs to be shown? There's a criteria that we use in a lot of conversation based on certain subject matter and content. So it's a real thoughtful process, but it's definitely challenging and definitely disappointing when we can't show them all simply because we don't have enough time slots for them.
And for listeners who have not been to the festival, there are various programs, and within each program, you see at least three films on a variety of subjects. So, for example, Thursday's program kicks off at 4 o'clock. A couple of the names of the films, Living with the Oceans, Protecting Blue Whales and Blue Skies, China, Caging the Oceans Wild, Coral, Glimmer of Hope, For the Love of the Reef, just to give you an idea of the variety of the films that you'll see. And the other thing I love about this festival is that some of the filmmakers are in person, and there's always usually a talk after the film, and then there's also panel discussion. So there's a lot of interaction with the audience. And I'd love to get your take on the power of films, Suzanne. You're an award-winning British Columbia-based documentary filmmaker, and we were just talking with Anna about how films around climate change, ocean, marine life have really changed now that these issues are getting attention in the national media. And there's so much new research out about everything from plastic pollution to the state of the reefs.
Absolutely. And the power of film and the power of storytelling with one particular individual, for example, can help influence people enormously. It's easy to get depressed about the state of our oceans and the state of our planet in a state of climate change, but it seems a lot more manageable when we look at it individually and say there are things that we can do, and that's what we try to portray in our film, Call of the Baby Beluga. There are people out there who are really working to make a difference, and when you see a beluga whale looking you in the eye, it really connects it to the bigger issues that we all have to deal with.
It is a beautiful film, and we'll talk about it in a couple of minutes. But Michael, I also wanted to ask you, can you talk about the power of films? And as a filmmaker, I mean, you've been doing this for a while. You have directed and written over 20 stories for the National Geographic Channel. What are your thoughts on what has really changed now that these issues are getting so much more attention?
I think that one of the great things is that the technology simply allows us to get closer to animals, to watch what they're doing. Just simply the opportunity to look at belugas from drones, for instance, was amazing. But also the orcas in the Pacific Northwest who are endangered are benefiting hugely from the new information that people are getting by filming them from the air. There's some very simple things that have allowed us to understand and learn about animals without disrupting them, or in fact, by withdrawing some of the disruption that we have caused by doing research and filming because of things like that. Underwater cameras, all of the new technology has allowed us to get closer. There are also there's some philosophical changes in the way that stories are told. And we're reaching out more and more to ways of telling stories that are like feature films, in which we try to tell a story of somebody who has a desperate need to do something. And so the stories themselves are becoming more intriguing. Documentaries about wildlife, about many things, are no longer the sort of thing that you say, oh, yeah, I've got to go watch this documentary and they're going to fill me up with information and I'm not really going to care. That's not what documentaries are now. And I think that's a really marvelous change that has occurred over the past, 20 years or so. And that's that's part of the development of this whole outreach to the public through visual means. It's been very encouraging. We're able to do things that are inspiring, even things that are inspiring about very tough topics, because we're able to spend the time to spend time with people and film them.
Oh, that's a great point. Anna, what would you add to that? Michael's point about just how the storytelling has also changed.
That's a good point. And I think it's true in that, you know, people used to think of documentaries as a downer, a depressing story about some issue that needed to be discussed. But we're seeing more films that are, like Michael said, telling a story. The story is intriguing, and at the same time, we are documenting what is happening to a particular creature, to a particular coastal culture. And what we're also seeing is that these stories are providing solutions. So the documentary you see today is about an individual or an animal that has an incredibly interesting story. It's intriguing. And you are, in fact, watching a documentary, but it becomes so much more about the story that it's not the documentary of that we all grew up with, which was something we weren't so interested in watching because it was either depressing or a downer, etc. So these are much more uplifting and better storytelling.
Talk a little bit about some of the highlights this year, Anna. There are so many. Maybe talk about a few now, and then we can talk about a few later.
I'd love to. So the festival, for the first time, we're doing a VR screening, which kind of ties into storytelling in the sense that with the technology that we have, we can go deeper and we can show what's happening below the waterline, which is what is so fascinating for so many people. So we have two VR screenings that take place on Sunday from 10 to 2. One is called Immerse. And the other one is called 360 Coral Reefs. So they're both about coral reefs, about coral bleaching that has taken place, but they're also both much more uplifting and solutions-oriented in what we can do to protect coral reefs. So that's a very exciting component to the film festival this year. We also have our student film competition. I always like to give a shout-out to that program. It's on Sunday at 10 a.m. It's free to attend, and it's so exciting because we have kids from all over the world in middle school and high school who submit their films. And again, they have great stories to tell, and they have access to technology. So we had over, 75 submissions from 15 different countries. So very international.
Oh, wow.
Very interesting, very exciting to see these films. So the top 15 finalists will be screened at the film festival on Sunday.
And what struck you about the student films that were submitted this year?
I think just that they came from all over the world, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, I believe Canada, that these kids are aware that there is an opportunity for them to tell their story, that they have the technology, they can dive into filmmaking as a potential career, and that they love doing it. And I think that was what's so surprising, that we had so many different entries from so many different countries.
The student film competition will be shown Sunday, March 10th at 10 a.m. That is free to attend. It's at the Cal Theater in San Francisco. And then the virtual reality program is also Sunday at 10 from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Anna Blanco is executive director of the International Ocean Film Festival. It kicks off this Thursday in San Francisco. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are also joined by Suzanne Chisholm, an award-winning British Columbia-based documentary filmmaker, and Michael Parfitt, also an award-winning writer and filmmaker. They are co-directors of a beautiful film, Call of the Baby Beluga, and you can see that Saturday, March 8th at 4 p.m. at the Cal Theater. And if you'd like to join us, if I know that we have so many ocean lovers listening to the show, if you'd like to talk about a film that really grabbed your attention or just the power of films about plastic pollution, about coral reefs, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have any questions about baby belugas, we'd also love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Suzanne, this film is just so beautiful. It's about saving a baby beluga whale, but it tells the bigger story of what baby belugas face today, the history of baby belugas. What inspired you to make this film?
Yeah, thanks. There were lots of things that inspired us, but one of the really fascinating things about this particular population of beluga whales is that they are absolutely incredible and unique. The belugas are an Arctic species, and you have this incredible little population living in the St. Lawrence River. And for our American friends, on the West Coast in particular, just to get a sense of the geography, the St. Lawrence River is a very busy shipping way. All kinds of marine traffic goes up and down. And of course, the belugas existed there long before we humans made it into a very busy waterway. And these animals are managing to hang on to their habitat despite all the human activity. So there's an incredible story to tell in terms of the interface between wild animals and people, and particularly in the last couple of decades, the way that people have turned around and said, these animals are worth saving. And that's a big focus of our film, the work of the dedicated scientists who are trying to figure out ways to help protect this vulnerable and endangered population of belugas that live far outside what is their typical range.
Can you tell us a bit about Canada's St. Lawrence River?
Sure. Is that for me or for Mike to go
Yes,
ahead?
For you, Suzanne.
Yeah, the St. Lawrence River, it's not just Canada's. It does border parts of the eastern states in the United States. And it's a main waterway that ships travel all the way down to our big cities like Montreal and then even further down to the Great Lakes. The St. Lawrence River itself drains a huge watershed that includes the Great Lakes, which, of course, Canada shares with the United States. One consequence of that is that every little bit of pollution that goes into those Great Lakes flows out through the St. Lawrence River into the Atlantic Ocean. And the belugas, of course, live in that estuary where the ocean meets the outflow of the river. So everything that we humans have done, we think about all those big industrial cities on the Great Lakes, that have been pouring pollution into that river for 100 years or more, that has an impact on all the creatures, and particularly creatures high up the food chain, like the belugas and the many other species of whales that are found in that river. So again, it's a classic story of how do people strike a balance with wild animals in a very busy place.
We also learn that few other wild animals are as closely connected to human beings as belugas from the St. Lawrence River. They are very social. They live in complex societies. They live between 50 and 80 years. Michael, what else can you tell us about just how amazing belugas are? It was just so great to learn about them.
Well, it was really, really exciting for us to learn about them as well, because once you start to dig into another animal, what you often find out is that they look very simple on the surface. Literally with whales, they're very simple on the surface. You just see the spout and a little bit of a back up here. Under the water, they do all kinds of things, and their societies are enormously complex. And, of course, with a very complex social society, these animals have to kind of figure out who is who, who's related to whom, and so on. So they do all of these things that we do naturally, too, but you don't see it. One of the great things is we were able to use a drone. This was early on in the drone business. A couple of years ago, we were doing this filming. And we were able to see the way the animals look down on them, because they live quite close to the surface, and see the way they were interacting. And their interactions are very complicated. And because people have learned how to identify animals by markings on them, the scientists know many of them as individuals. And so they can say, well, you know, so-and-so is off this week up in this area where the groups have a tendency to gather, and what are they doing there? Nobody knows exactly what they're doing. The closest thing you can come to is that they are simply going to a certain place to socialize. Now that's kind of dramatic when you think about about animals. So you suddenly, this window opens, as these people have been studying them, into the lives of animals that live in ways that are as complicated as our lives. Now they're not identical, they're not the same, they're not saying they think like humans. What we're saying is they have these complex lives that are just fascinating to watch, and you can never sort of get to the bottom of it. So you're always turning up new questions. That's one of the reasons that the story that we saw there is so rich, and it's so inspiring because it's so fascinating.
Can you talk about the amazing tie between the mother and baby?
Well, it is quite extraordinary. They're complicated mammals, and they have a long childhood, sort of like humans do. And so the connection between the mother and the baby is, in many ways, is just as strong, if not stronger, than it is between human mothers and their children, because the males aren't really involved in it. And so the mother and the baby stay together for a very long time. Now, they're a little different from the orcas, which other people may know about, where the mothers and their young stay together for life. With the belugas, it doesn't work like that. But they stay together for about 10 years. And the babies, while they're staying with their mothers, are a different color. They're kind of grayish. They don't really get white until they're sort of mature and they start to separate out. But that bond is extraordinary, which is, of course, the core of our story, which is that a baby turned up on the beach alone, and people found her there, and she was in good physical condition, and so the puzzle was how can you save this baby? We don't know what's happened to her mother, and her mother's likely died. So you have this enormous puzzle that begins our film, and it's based upon this very, very powerful relationship, which includes babysitting. You can see this from the air. You can see that a mother will often take care of another mother's baby for a while the second mother is off hunting or something. So you have these intricate relationships, and that becomes part of the way that the scientists were trying to resolve the problem of how do you help this little baby.
That footage was so amazing, of seeing another mom take care of the baby, and then the baby's mom went off and, as you said, do something. I mean, the footage in the film overall is amazing, but that particular moment was just incredible. So you got that from drone footage?
Yes. I mean, one of the real puzzles that we had when we started work on this project, these are long projects. They take well over a year, two or three to do sometimes, and was that the St. Lawrence River is murky. I mean, you could drop a bright light into the water and it would disappear about 3 feet down. So it's very hard to see. And also, we had a permit to film them underwater if we stayed 400 meters away. So we couldn't even do that. So how on earth were we going to see these animals? And the solution was these little drones. So we got a permit to film from the air. And we were worried that we would scare them with this little drone that we had. And they didn't, they never noticed it. It didn't bother them at all, which was wonderful. So we were able to sit over them, look down in the water, and because they swim very shallow, they're very close to the surface a lot of the time, we got to see some of these things. And it was really exciting. We started showing this to the scientists. These were people who had studied these animals for 30 years, and they said, wow, I haven't seen that behavior before. I haven't seen them doing that. So we were able to help the scientists out while we were doing this work. It was really an exciting thing.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. I mean, and the scientists that you interviewed, they're so dedicated. I mean, dedicating their lives to saving belugas, that must have been an amazing experience for you, for both of you. Suzanne, go ahead.
It is. It's always inspiring as storytellers to find people who are so committed to the art and the science of helping our planet. And specifically, for example, one of the researchers with whom we worked, Dr. Valeria Vergara. She came there, and we filmed her initially with her first collaborations with Robert Michaud from the organization that researches the belugas there. And she went back again and again, and consequently and subsequently, she discovered some amazing acoustic features of these whales. They actually have different, they're called contact calls, and they actually have what's called a name tag. They have their own name tag that they use to identify themselves. And Valeria has compared it to, you know, a whale coming up to another one saying, hello, and hello, my name is. So, you know, we humans like to think that we're the only ones who are so sophisticated to self-identify with names, but actually it's been discovered in dolphins and then now in belugas. So that's pretty neat stuff. So it's easy to see why these scientists are so inspired by their work, but they need to be dedicated to, because they often are out there in pretty unpleasant conditions, and there's all the stuff that goes wrong in the field, but they stick to their goal, and it's lovely to be able to be in the company of people like that.
Yeah, Suzanne Chisholm. Michael, we're going to take a quick break. Yep. Hold that thought.
Great.
Thank you. Suzanne Chisholm and Michael Parfit are co-directors of a beautiful documentary, Call of the Baby Beluga. And you can see it this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Cal Theater in San Francisco. If you're out of the area after the break, we'll also find out how you can see it. We're also joined by Anna Blanco, Executive Director of the International Ocean Film Festival, which begins this Thursday in San Francisco. There will also be some films in San Rafael. Find more information, yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call's One Planet series, and we'll be back after this.
The president has made it clear.
We cannot be the policemen of the world.
But for a brief moment after the Cold War, it was. Nowadays, Russia, China, and Iran are working hard to destabilize Western democracies in general and the American system in particular. What can we do about that? Author Michael Mandelbaum on the rise and fall of peace on Earth. That's next time on 1A.
You can hear 1A at 11 o'clock, just one half hour from now, here on 91.7 KALW. This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with immigration attorney J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda about his new book, No Human is Illegal. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about the annual International Ocean Film Festival, which kicks off in San Francisco this Thursday. We're joined by Anna Blanco, Executive Director of the festival. You can find more information about all of the incredible films at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Suzanne Chisholm and Michael Parfit. They are award-winning filmmakers and co-directors of Call of the Baby Beluga, a beautiful film about efforts to save belugas. And that film is screening Saturday, March 8th, this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Cal Theater in San Francisco. And if you have a question or comment for our guests, if you'd like to talk about the power of films raising awareness about everything from belugas to plastic pollution to coral reefs, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Suzanne, for people outside of the area who would like to see this film, is that possible right now?
Well, for Canadians, yes. They can see it on CBC on the Nature of Things program, and that is available streaming, but only in Canada, unfortunately. So for our friends south of the border at the moment, get yourselves up and go see it this Saturday at the Ocean Film Festival.
All right, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org. Anna, what really struck you about this film, Call of the Baby Beluga?
I think what I like so much about it is the scientific approach and the scientists and their passion for wanting to help this baby beluga. But also, I don't think we've had a really good film like this about baby belugas. We just haven't had a lot of films about belugas, period. And there's just so much conversation right now about belugas in captivity. And it's always fun to show a new topic, a new species that we haven't presented before. So that's what, and it was such a poetic story. It was done so beautifully. And it's a film, one of the films that you'll never forget. And we have a lot of those films in the festival. And I think that's what's so powerful about it. You learn something new, and you meet some very interesting people, and you'll never forget about it. And you'll see belugas in a different way.
Yeah, and it's also inspiring because as much as they are in trouble, it's so nice to know that there are people out there who are dedicating their lives, for example, to saving these belugas. I mean, they just care so much about belugas. And you could say the same. I mean, you've got films about sharks. You always have films about sharks, but the same thing about sharks, dolphins, orcas, you name it. I mean, that's what's inspiring about the festival.
That's correct. I mean, we just have such a wide variety of subject matter, of films, length of films. So I like to say that there's something for everybody. There's also films about surfing and sailing and how we engage with the ocean. So indeed, there is something for everybody, and there's a variety of subject matter. So take a look and join us. These are all films that you'll never forget, and they're all very special, very well done films by independent filmmakers from all over the world.
Suzanne, can you talk about where beluga whales are most concentrated? Do we know?
Yes, absolutely. Belugas are an Arctic species. So most of the belugas in the world live, by far the most, live in the Canadian Arctic, the Russian Arctic, Greenland. You just look at that area, the polar area to the north. The St. Lawrence beluga species, of course, it's sort of like a subpopulation. They're the only group that lives outside that polar region. So there's large populations, and just to be clear, and also Alaska, of course, large populations in the north that are not endangered. It's just this particular population that's endangered as well as in Alaska. And of course, as was mentioned, there's a lot of talk recently about belugas in captivity and belugas in Russia. So there's lots going on now.
There's footage of the Arctic, so you can see what they're like when they're in a normal population. They're all somewhat threatened everywhere in the world, along with all wildlife, because of various things we've done. But there's some very interesting shots there of very large groups and of these belugas, and you can actually see a thing which is sort of a kindergarten. If you look closely, you'll see a bunch of kids, little babies, swimming around together.
You also have some information in here about the history of belugas, about how humans killed belugas for leather and oil in the 1860s. They were captured alive for show business. We also learned that in the 1920s, they were accused of competing with the fishing industry, and people were paid to kill them. And luckily that ended when scientists looked into the stomachs of belugas and saw mostly small fish, not cod. What else really stands out for you when you look at the history of belugas? Suzanne, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things about our relationship to the St. Lawrence belugas and to whales in general is that in the last 30 or 40 years, people's attitudes toward whales has really changed. It used to be that people didn't pay much attention to them. We didn't know a lot about them. If you think about the orcas on our west coast here, people didn't think of them as being incredible creatures with complex social lives and animals that we could look toward for inspiration and love. And you look now, there are actually very few countries in the world where people still hunt whales. You could count them on one hand, and attitudes are changing towards the value of these creatures to us, not just in terms of their importance to our broader ecosystems, but their importance to us as people. People love whales, and that has changed. For a long time, they were scapegoats. For a long time, they were seen as ways to make money. You think of the whaling history of so many countries in the last couple of centuries. We've changed, and we're better because of that.
Michael?
Yeah, I think we get very pessimistic about the human relationship
relationship to the planet sometimes. People in general do. I think that all you need to do is look at the change in the relationship to whales, and you can see that we do not have to be pessimistic. We can change. Human beings can change their attitude toward the planet dramatically. The change in our attitude toward whales is dramatic, and we see it through the belugas. And so we have to expect ourselves to behave differently because we can.
Well, and what's connected to that is another great story you tell in the film, and that is in the 60s, there was a lot of new research about the intelligence and social lives of dolphins and whales, and people started to think again about how to treat them. And you tell an amazing story. I love these women, these two journalists from Toronto who came to the St. Lawrence River in 1973, Heather Malcolm and Leon Pappard. And it was just great to see Leon Pappard, who became an activist and an advocate for belugas, and she helped stop sport hunting for belugas and then helped get them on the endangered species list. What another great story you tell in this film, exactly. Suzanne.
Yeah, and I think every whale species, and in fact, I don't want to focus only on whales because, as Anna will mention, there's all these other amazing species that are shown in films that are at the festival now, but I think every species needs a champion. You know, in so many ways, Leon and Heather were pioneers. You think of that era when, and again, that was an era where people didn't really know a lot about belugas or whales in general. And you think about when humans first heard the recorded calls of humpback whales and how that played such a huge role in changing our attitudes. You look this past summer, there was a tragic story out of the Pacific Northwest here in which an orca mom carried her dead calf around for days and days and days, and it was covered, you know, in the New York Times, where, you know, people are very far removed from orcas in the wild, but it shows the way that first of all, we're learning more and more about what these animals do and how they interact with each other, and that in turn is helping people care more and more and pledging to do more to protect habitats and species.
And if you think about those two women that were working, they didn't know what they were going to be able to do. They just did it because they believed in it. And I think that when we look at those things, again, we can get these longer-term, bigger messages, and those are, you can bring change. One person, a couple of friends, taking action can bring about change. And it often takes a lot of determination and ability to overcome hardship and difficulties and losses and places where you're terribly discouraged, but it can be done.
Anna, what would you add? I think it's, again, it's inspiring to hear about how things actually do change thanks to the great work of these journalists, the scientists, the filmmakers, the festival. I mean, it's just about really spreading awareness and getting the word out.
I agree. I think it's interesting, and Suzanne made a good point. It's always good for every species to have its champion, and so this film is bringing a lot of awareness around the conversation of beluga whales, but there's a lot of other countries that still do whaling illegally, and I think we need to remember that, and I think there needs to be advocacy and films about what's happening for them, and we do see that. I think that's what's so interesting about the film festival is that we get dedicated filmmakers who decide to bring an issue to the big screen, and then that gets the conversation going. And when you start talking about something, you give a voice to these animals, you give a voice to the ocean, which it desperately needs in order to protect it. And film has a way of doing that. So when I saw this film, I really wanted to share the story of belugas and wanted to start that conversation. And we do. We have many different species that are covered in the films, and it's just a good way to get a conversation started. It can go to our panel discussions, and it's a real catalyst for people who want to learn more and who want to have a conversation after the film. And like Michael keeps saying, you can affect change. And we've been on the show before with you, Rose, talking about particular films. Like last year, it was Straws. The year before that, it was Sand Wars. These films that really help to create the change that we need. And done by very inspiring filmmakers. And everyone walks away inspired to make some change.
Anna Blanco is Executive Director of the International Ocean Film Festival. It begins this Thursday and runs through Sunday in San Francisco. Films will also be shown in San Rafael. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. Suzanne Chisholm and Michael Parfit are award-winning filmmakers and co-directors of Call of the Baby Beluga, a beautiful documentary that will be shown this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Cal Theater. You can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, as you know, every Monday, after the election, we decided to focus every Monday's show on all of the issues we're talking about today, whether it's climate change, plastic pollution, the state of orcas. So if you have any questions or comments about the power of films, and just really so much has changed in the last, say, 10 years, just about awareness raising on these issues, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. What really grabs you when it comes to films and taking action on these issues? Let's hear from Ariane in San Francisco. Hi, Ariane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a few comments. The first is that at the time that Moby Dick was written, people were able to smell the breath of whales in the harbor outside of Boston. And if we think about that novel so many years ago, really, when we think about the change from domination to dominion, the real challenge for humans is to learn how to master oneself, to come into control over oneself and not other species. And the second thing that I want to say is that they've done clinical studies showing that people have more empathy with other individuals whom they perceive as similar to themselves. And so I really appreciate all these films where there's like an underscoring of how similar we are in some ways to our animal brothers and sisters. And yet I also feel like we're living on the lip of extinction, and I would really hope that at some point this foments a movement where we have a legal approach in which we come to understand the rights of nature. Your guest said that the oceans, like the forests, don't have the ability to voice their needs and concerns, and we usually look at these places as places to mine for fish, for wood, for places to build and ravage, and that has to change. And unfortunately, we're at the stage where we may need to bring in lawyers and justice advocates as well. But I really appreciate that the filmmakers are trying to enhance the empathy that people have or might have in the awareness of diverse species. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ariane. Well, the lawyers are already being brought in. In fact, 60 Minutes did a piece last night, which I still need to watch, called The Climate Change Lawsuit That Could Stop the U.S. Government from Supporting Fossil Fuels. This is the suit that was filed on behalf of 21 children alleging that the government knowingly failed to protect them from climate change. And we'll do a show about that on a future Monday. Anna, would you like to respond to Ariane's comments?
I couldn't agree more. We're seeing a lot more filmmakers who are showing how we engage with animals in the ocean. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, they are they're like us, and we need to protect them, and we need to understand them more than anything and do what we can to continue to protect them. You know, there's a film that I think of quite often at the festival. It's called Protecting Blue Whales in Blue Skies. And it's a short film, but it's about changing shipping lanes because of all of the ship strikes that are taking place in our oceans with the increased amount of shipping that's taking place. So little changes like that, legislation changes, can have a big impact and make a big difference. And I think it's just through our better understanding of how similar we are to these animals that is helping to create these changes that we need.
Protecting Blue Whales and Blue Skies screens Thursday, this Thursday at 4 o'clock at the Cal Theater in San Francisco, along with a number of other short films. You can find information, yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to give a shout out to a film that really affected you, if you bring your kids to these films and you'd like to talk about how they were affected, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Speaking of policy changes, that's another issue that you also explored in the film, Michael. Can you talk about what activists and scientists have been able to accomplish for beluga whales? We mentioned a few things, but there's actually a fairly long list.
Well, there's a lot of things, and it's very interesting sort of the process of how some of these policies change. And you see all of that happening, and people like Leon Pipard and other people that were in the film, the historical people, had to go to government and persuade government to change. But the way they did that was by engaging the public, and that's one of the things in democracy that actually works, which is you can get an engaged public and you can actually change things. And among the things that they helped change was the pollution in the Great Lakes and in the St. Lawrence, and particularly with the aluminum smelters and things that were pouring this chemicals in the water that would demonstrably cause cancer in the animals. And as a result, there are still many threats to these animals, but the cancer rate has declined. So this is where policy change really makes a difference. And of course, the overall policy change of not killing these animals is very significant. So these things are really important. One other thing I want to mention, and that is that our film is this wonderful case study of women in science. Anybody who thinks that we don't have role models out there for women in science can just come and watch our movie. These people are pioneers in science, and it's dominated by women in this particular case in our film. So these are changes that are happening, and sometimes they're visible. You can see them, and you talk about them in a film. Sometimes it's just the background. This is just happening. But your question about policy change, it clearly made a huge difference to these belugas.
Yeah, huge difference. Suzanne, what would you add?
I would add again. Don't give up hope. So whatever your issue might be, I think the experience of people advocating for the belugas of the St. Lawrence, and in the bigger picture, the health of the St. Lawrence and that entire ecosystem, it was a slog for these people. Leon Pipard and Heather Malcolm, they were out there on their own. A lot of people thought, you know, what are these women doing? It's hard to be a trailblazer. It's hard to be out there in the field and start speaking. You think about the history of just people acknowledging that other animals might have emotions and that they have complex brains. It's been a hard slog for scientists and for advocates, but keep up the good fight, because the more we learn, the more that enables us to advocate for these species and protection of their habitat and in a bigger picture, protection of our oceans.
Right, which, as you both have said, translates into action from the public. Anna, I wanted to ask you about the story of captured belugas in Russia. That has been getting a lot of attention. The owners of four companies are accused of keeping 100 belugas and orcas in cages in Russia's Far East. These companies have a history of illegally capturing them, basically stealing them from the ocean, selling animals to amusement parks, and to China. And the Associated Press reports that because of the international outcry over the horrendous conditions under which these animals were kept, the Russian authorities are going to free them, and they're going to prosecute the owners of these companies. I mean, this is huge.
It is huge. And I think that's so interesting to see how when people come together, and I've seen so much of it on social media, and I've seen stories in the news, and it's really, again, raising awareness about an issue in order to create change. So for these animals, and the captivity was just horrendous. I think they had ice was frozen over. They were held in pens in the ocean, but it was so cold that it was frozen on top. They couldn't poke their heads out. Just horrific conditions for them. And so it's always good to see when people come together and, you know, you have a bigger voice and change actually happens. So we're very excited for this particular issue.
Yeah, this is a big one. We'll watch this. Mm. The other films that come to mind, obviously, are the big ones, The Cove. And in fact, the killing in Taiji just ended a couple of days ago. Unfortunately, that didn't get as much attention. I feel like so much of the air, the space is taken with what's happening in Washington. But that is a very important issue. Blackfish really changed the way people look at captivity. I mean, Anna, the debate about captivity has just reached new levels thanks to films like Blackfish.
That's true. I mean, when Blackfish came out, and I believe it was on CNN, and it was shown many times, that really had an impact on animals in captivity in SeaWorld. It affected their attendance, their ticket sales. It affected their stock price. A dramatic change based on one particular film and people coming forward to make a statement about animals in captivity. So we're seeing more films like that. I think we have one this year called Caging, China Caging the Oceans Wild. That's another film about whales and dolphins in captivity. So that's on Thursday at 4 o'clock as well.
Final thoughts from all of you at a time when things are pretty dire. I mean, the IPCC report says we have to take action in 12 years. We're learning so much about what's happening underwater. At the same time, we've got these amazing films, all of the amazing people that you profile who are creating change to save these beautiful creatures. Final thoughts from you, Suzanne, about just where we're at and, you know, the most effective thing someone can do to take action on these issues.
I agree. I think we're at a crucial time, and we all fear crises in our ocean and in our land and in our air. I think the bottom line is we can't give up hope. We can't give up hope in terms of the power of science, the power of storytelling, the power of our emotions and how we respond. And I liked what Ariane said about our empathy toward other species. We have to keep those in our minds and in our hearts. Otherwise, we're not going to care. So we need to remember all these important things. We need to champion the work of people who are out there trying to change things. And we need to continue to put pressure on our government. You know, just back to the issue of whale captivity. Those issues are before the Canadian Parliament and Senate, and that's not because of the work of just a couple of politicians. That's because of all the human pressure. So we need to keep fighting for these things that we believe in, and we need to look to science to back up our fights.
Suzanne Chisholm is an award-winning filmmaker, co-director of Call of the Baby Beluga. Michael, we have about 30 seconds.
No, she said don't give up, and that's the message of this film. Not only that, but this film shows that you can do this work, have a great time doing it, and do something that's meaningful. And I think we want to see more people like the people in our film go into the science and actually recognize that they can make a difference, because knowing that you can is part of restoring optimism and getting there.
Michael Parfit is co-director of Call of the Baby Beluga, a beautiful documentary that will be screening this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Cal Theater, Fort Mason in San Francisco. Michael and Suzanne, thank you so much for making this beautiful film and for all of your work, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here and to talk to you. Thank you.
A lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Anna Blanco is executive director of the International Ocean Film Festival. I hope you can go to this festival if you're in the area. It kicks off this Thursday in San Francisco. Films will also be shown in San Rafael. Anna, again, thank you and all of your team for putting this amazing festival together. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.